Hi, this is Barney Butterfield of Sandford Orchards, located in Devon, England, in the southwest of England, the cider making heartlands, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 182. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week on Cider Chat, we have a featured conversation with Barney Butterfield of Sandford Orchard, and he's going to be talking about straw pressing cider. That means that they use reed as the rack, and barley straw is the cloth. And if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about with rack and cloth, well, you know, there's some way you got to squeeze that apple to get out the juice. And we're going to learn about the traditional method that they still use at Sandford Orchards to make traditional cider. It's absolutely fascinating. Can't wait to share that chat with you. But meanwhile, a bit of news out and about in Ciderville. Last week's episode 181 was featuring a new cider book written by Susanna Forbes of Little Pomona. That chat was a recording with both Susanna and James Forbes, and we were talking primarily about the cider and cider, but also about their ciders too at this cidery. So it's a really great chat if you haven't listened to it. The other piece is, as this podcast is going live now, it has just ended a Twitter contest featuring that book for one lucky winner, a signed copy of the Cider Insider 100 Craft Ciders to Drink Now. And we were doing this to really help Susanna and to kind of broadcast cider overall, because that book is now available in the U.S. So there's going to be a link in the show notes for this here episode 182 where you could get a copy. I highly recommend it. It has more than 100 ciders in it, because she's recommending if you can't get this and get that. So it's a very generous write-up about cider overall, something that I feel every cider bar should have in their tasting room for people to peruse and just get a sense what's out there. It doesn't have to be all about one brand. Cider, you know, when one cider goes up, it brings all the ciders up at the same time. And that's what I love about the work that she does. And certainly, I really enjoy their ciders too. So check that out in the links in the show note. Sorry if you missed out on that Twitter contest. I will be announcing the winner next week. So stay tuned for that. And that's a little probably encouragement to try to at least check in with Cider Chat as each week goes along, because you never know when a contest is going to come up and you don't want to miss it. Sometimes it's a very short window of time, even though it's a week long. Right. When I come back, a little bit more news from Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. We like orchards and having some fun.
I received an email from a listener who is based in Virginia, and his first name is Mark. And he's also a patron of Cider Chat. In case you don't know what Patreon is, it is a website that helps myself and other content providers, producers, keep on creating. So it's kind of like leaving a tip for your bartender when you go out to a cider bar or a tasting room. I imagine if you're like me, you're leaving a tip in the jar. And this is one way to help support this podcast, is by leaving a tip and whatever it's worth for you. Hopefully, listening to this podcast each week, you are getting something worthwhile. Otherwise, I don't know why you'd be listening, right? So Mark was saying, and he wrote, "I always love learning more about fermented beverages, but cider in particular, because there aren't many cideries in my area that make products that I enjoy. That's not to say that they're not making a good product, just that most of it is not to my liking. There are two places that I have stumbled upon that make cider that he enjoys. The first is a place called Garden Grove in Richmond, Virginia. They make all sorts of crazy crossover beverages, but their new World Dry Apple Cider stands out as being a very refreshing beverage. So there's a little kick out to Garden Grove in Richmond. And then the second location he mentioned was Hilltop Winery in Nellisford, Virginia. Like Garden Grove, they have an interesting assortment of beverages. In this case, their Perry really stood out to me. So I found that pretty interesting on both accounts. I actually have not had cider from either of those places. And to hear that Hilltop has a Perry, now I wonder if they are making that with Perry pears. We use this term Perry really all over the map in the U.S. And I'll see someone calling their beverage a Perry when there's actually just a small amount of pears. They might even be culinary pears. And then there's a lot of apple-based cider in that. One that comes to mind is Perry out at Stem Cider in Colorado. They class their large 750 ml bottle as a Perry, but it is actually a what I would call a pear cider. So I don't know. I mean, in the U.S., I'd never really know until I actually taste it or see the bottle and or the write-up. So that's interesting. It's pretty cool that they're even approaching that in Virginia. He continues with, "I'm always open to trying out new places. If you know of any new cideries in Virginia, please let me know. Likewise, if you're ever in this neck of the woods, let me know so we can raise a glass together." And indeed I will, Mark. I would so enjoy that. And I'm going to keep my eye out for new cideries coming up. I'm sure you probably know all the current cideries there for sure. I remember that you also wrote that you liked Sizer, as I do too. In fact, a good friend of mine just gave me a cider that is from like 1990. Whoa, right? I have not cracked that open. I did drink a mead that he just gave me. I'm super fond of sizers, and sometimes people make sizers with a lot of honey. It's almost like on that mead level. But if, in case those listeners out there who don't know what I'm talking about in terms of sizer, in my case, whenever I add honey in the fermenting process to a cider, I call it sizer. That's just my clarification of it. Some people will not. They'll just continue calling it a cider. So it's one of those kind of gray areas, just like Perry is, at least in the U.S. In other countries, it's pretty darn strict what can be a Perry and what isn't a Perry. Anywho, I just really appreciate hearing from Mark. It's exciting for me to hear exactly what he does like, and it's kind of cool to see that he likes the New World Dry Apple Cider. That's telling me about your palate and where you're going, so that's super neat. And thank you, Mark, for being a patron of Cider Chat via the Cider Chat Patreon page. If you're like Mark and you find value in this podcast, if you spend an hour of your time each week listening, if not more, downloading it for long trips, it's helped you work on your own cider making skills. Perhaps you're a commercial cider maker who has gotten value, you know, or initiative through the podcast. Do consider joining Mark and other patrons in supporting Cider Chat. And if that doesn't work for you, well, there's always PayPal, and there's a link to do a donation via PayPal. You could find all that and more at ciderchat.com.
Walking through the orchards, dancing in the street, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
It's time to grab a glass and join the chat with Barney Butterfield of Sanford Orchard, based in the UK. I met up with Barney at CiderCon 2019 in Chicago. CiderCon is the annual trade conference put on by the United States Association of Cider Makers. While I was at the conference, I got a direct message via my Twitter account at CiderChat that Barney was on his way to Chicago and he would like to meet up with me to talk cider. Having not had the opportunity to speak with him when he was at CiderCon in Portland, Oregon, that was my first CiderCon I ever attended, and I guess he was also at Baltimore, though I never saw him the year before. I was just so stoked to be able to meet up with him and hear what he was doing at Stanford Orchards. Now, in this chat, we're focusing primarily on the straw bale cider-making technique that they do during the pressing. So we're going to hear all about that. And then at the end, I'm going to give you a little bit of an update about an extended bonus clip version of this that'll be available for patrons of Cider Chat. But in the meanwhile, there is just so much to learn about Sanford Orchard, told best by Barney Butterfield, and a specific traditional cider making technique that I know you will likely enjoy as much as I do. So fill that glass and get ready to go. We're headed now to this main chat with Barney Butterfield. We begin this chat by Barney giving us an idea exactly where Sanford Orchards is located and how he got into cider making.
We are surrounded by the Atlantic and the English Channel, so we're a maritime environment. And although we're at 52 degrees, we're warm, and it's the Gulf Stream that keeps us warm. The soil structures that we're on are Permian Triassic, so it's a red sandstone base, and it's kind of perfect for apple trees, which is why we have so many. And we have enough cool in the winter for winter vernalization, so that we're getting strong responses from the trees in the spring. Great warmth and the right amount of rainfall. And we feel the right amount of stress, the perfect amount of stress for the tree to produce the high quality and high flavor that we get. There is a sweet spot in fruit production. If you just wanted weight, bushel weight per canopy, hectare or whatever, then you might choose a slightly drier environment. But actually, part of that stress is what's giving us wonderful flavors from our fruit. So we're happy. We've been doing it for 1,000 years or so, and it seems to work.
I think over a course of 1,000 years,
you get your iron.
Yeah, exactly. And that region has quite a few cider makers.
It does.
Yeah, a very strong tradition.
Yeah,
locally. Wonderful. Well, your specific cider brand is Sanford Orchards.
That's right.
And let's talk about your roots in cider making. Where did that stem from for you?
Well, I was working for a local farmer, so I grew up in the rural Devon, and I didn't earn enough money on the farm to go out drinking as often as I felt I needed to, and so I could have got a better job, or I could make my own cider. So I wasn't good enough to get a better job, so instead I made my own cider. So, and the farmer, the part of the tradition in the west of England has always been cider has made up part of people's wages. But really, it wasn't quite people being doled out cider, although there will have been farms like that. So the farmer would give his workers the means to produce their own cider. So a bit of a barn, the corner of a barn, and some, allowed to take some fruit.
And a barrel?
Right.
A barrel. So it was all barrel, like a wood. Would the farmer... What size barrels were people just... Was it like a large barrel or much smaller?
Commonly what we would call a hogshead, which is a hogshead or 45-gallon or imperial gallon, so that would be... so that would be the typical...
Size for a farmhand.
Yeah. And interestingly, the farms with the best orchards on the best ground... for orchard would be the best businesses. And so if you go around Devon, you'll see some mighty wonderful farms. Now, there's no other agricultural reason why they would do well, but because they made good cider, they got good stuff, they're drinking that cider all year long, then if you're the best ploughman in the valley, you're going to go straight to the best farm.
Absolutely.
And that's what's going to happen. And so the two things were completely intertwined.
Yeah.
So the success of the farm and the success of the cider were hugely important. And my father-in-law's farm, where, because I ended up, I didn't just, he let me make cider, and then approached his daughter, which was very naughty, but a wonderful man, and had taught me a great deal.
Awesome.
But he laughs because famously his farm, which is a wonderful farm, was famous for making terrible cider. And he said, all the thrashers said, oh yeah, we never wanted to work up here. Because, yeah, back in the day, the ground was harder, higher, so it was much higher above sea level. And so you wouldn't get the goodness out of your apples, and so the cider would have been rougher. So
wow. Yeah. So you had a little bit more of an incentive to stay on that farm besides the cider. That's perfect. I love it.
Yeah.
So that's where you kind of got your roots and just making cider on your own and seeing what other local folks are doing in terms of cider. And then the actual brand itself, when did that kind of launch itself? When did you turn that into...
Well, I thought I launched it in 2002 because it felt like I'd made a lot of cider, because I made a couple of hundred gallon, and that seemed like a lot compared to, you know, what one might make.
Sure.
But really, we got going with it properly, so it became a business that suddenly needed to start to contribute in about 2009. So we've been running since 2002, but 2009... We got the tenancy, so my wife and I got the tenancy of a small farm on the edge of Crediton, and that allowed us to really put the energy into the business and build it.
Mm-hmm.
My wife gave me an ultimatum. She said, "You've got 2 years. You either turn this into a real business or stop mucking about." And that was the incentive I needed. There's nothing like the incentive of trying to prove your partner wrong. To really keep you focused.
That's right. There you go. And I imagine, you know, even though as an outsider looking into your landscape and all the ciders there, it's probably still like it's a scary business to go into, to actually make it viable and long-lasting. You have to be a savvy business person to do that, besides being a cider maker.
You'd be the first person to accuse me of being a savvy business.
Oh, really? Well.
but
I think you are. Being very, you know, shy about that.
Well,
you have to be.
Well, I mean, and I suppose the reality of starting a cider business in Devon is that you've got split fortunes, because there, you know, the amount of help I got was amazing. The resources are there. The apples are there.
Yeah, yeah.
But the competition's there.
It is, yeah.
So, I wonder
about that.
But this is what's so great about CiderCon, and it's great about any time when you start putting people with the same interests together. You could either be flimsy and so, you know, you start to feel awkward, the competition and the company, or you realise how we all push each other forward by being together. And and so where you have a lot of makers, you're going to have to, your bottom line is you've got to get better. Everyone got
absolutely
to get better.
And then,
and then the category grows and the category widens and interesting things happen, which is like what's happened with some of our, you know, trial fermentations and some of the new ciders we're making. It's that desire to push the limits and see where you can get to that, you know, that brings these things on.
Absolutely, absolutely. So also you're kind of making your region a mecca to go to. You know, people want to go to Devon because there's, you know, good cider to be had. It's a reason then to visit, tourism, everything kind of feeds off of one another. Your particular brand, you're a little modern.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And traditional, is that how you would classify it in your cider styles?
Yeah, we do. But we create some very traditional ciders.
Yeah,
absolutely recognizable. Yeah. We still press 1,000 gallons or more through straw every year.
So let's talk about that for listeners who have no concept of how cider is being made, and not that we have to get super technical, but. Straw, and this is not something we've actually discussed much on Cider Chat. So, can you just give us like a visual of what that looks like?
Yeah, well,
it's pretty cool.
I can, and if you search Sanford Orchard straw pressed on Vimeo, you see a wonderful time lapse film. What we're doing is the cider press itself is wide, so imagine a 6 feet, maybe 8 feet wooden dish, where the juice runs into a half barrel keeve. We're going to end up putting 2 tons of fruit on that one press. And it's built up in layers. And we use a combination of thatching reeds. So you've seen the thatched houses in Devon, mm-hmm. perhaps, in and barley straw. And so if you're familiar with a rack and cloth press, and a lot of cider makers will mm-hmm. be familiar with mm-hmm. The cloth rack, it's working in a very similar way. But effectively the reed is the rack and the barley straw is the cloth. So we'll lie the reed out past the edges of the dish, mm-hmm. And then we will heap on the milled apple. Goes mm-hmm. through a belt-driven knife mill in this mm-hmm. instance, powered off the back of a tractor.
Awesome.
And we'll level that out, and then we will sprinkle barley straw relatively thickly over the top, allowing us to make our next layer. And then we'll lay the reed out. And what happens is you then fold the reed around the apple mock, and then you build it up and up. Now, we do it in the Devon way. So the Devon press is a single iron screw going up through the middle, and we build around that. The Somerset way are two screws either side of the press with a beam coming down. We build around it, and the real skill, so a lot of people would use a wooden former, but the real skill that we do with the family who've been making cider on this farm for countless generations. They have an old screw from an old press that's dated in the 1400s.
Wow, jeez.
That would be elm.
Elm wood. Yeah.
Wow. Hand carved.
A screw.
Yeah. That's hand carved. That's
beautiful.
6 feet. Oh,
wow.
It is. It's amazing. Wow. But that will be built, and you'd see it if you look it up, you'll see it's built wide at the bottom and gradually in like a truncated pyramid, so that you can maximize the amount of fruit you can put on. So you've got a wide dish at the bottom, but the cap with the pressure on the top is smaller. And so rather than using
a pyramid?
Yeah, exactly. A pyramid.
Okay.
It is.
Yeah.
It looks.
Yeah.
And that way you get more apples in one single pressing. If you use a former, a wooden square with the bottom knocked out, as it were. It's going to be the same size all the way up.
Right.
And
right.
It's cheating. The truth is, with the Devon way, you can't put because you got the screw in the middle as well. You couldn't really use a former because you couldn't get it off.
How do you stop the apple pomace? And when he says he's putting the apples on there, these are all ground up apples.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the pomace yet, it's just ground up apples ready to be squeezed. Mm. How do you keep it from does it squeeze out a bit out of the straw?
Yeah, if you so when you're folding in, so you're using you're using just the right amount of straw to act as the cloth to prevent mm-hmm. it squeezing out. You have to remember that putting the mock up, as we would call it, so as we build it up,
mm-hmm.
It's going to take three parts of a day.
Just to build it up, just to put it in place.
And the very weight of it, it'll start to run.
Oh,
and so
just by itself.
And you know, you're using manual action to screw it down.
Yeah.
And so it's a very slow, gradual, mm-hmm. and the juice runs off practically clear. For cider makers out there who are used to using rack and cloth or belt presses, most of those guys will recognize apple juice as a cloudy, murky product.
Right.
And it's amazing when you see. Now, that we're trying to do some work with the University of Exeter on the whether there is any other activity going on, so whether there's mm-hmm. any inoculation from the barley straw, something happening that's...
There's some flavor that must be happening, right? I mean, that's what I think. You're pulling in the straw and the barley, you know, the reeds and the barley out of the fields. Isn't that why you're doing this? Or is it just because you're trying to do it a traditional way? It has a lent flavor. I mean, and how long is it sitting? How long does that pressing take? It takes about a better part of a day to set it up. Then is it like a 24-hour slow press?
It depends what, you know, in the middle of harvest, if you're really trying to get through it, you can do a press a day.
Yeah.
And so, but it still take a full day to press.
Yeah.
If you think, there aren't many people who will mill an apple in the morning in the prep, and it'll still be pressing by the evening.
Okay.
But actually, commonly, we would usually have that press up for 2 to 3 days. So you'd do the first pressing Presswort wants to run out on day one,
mm-hmm.
And then leave it under pressure overnight, and more will run out. And then we use a hay knife, which is, it looks like a spade with a sharp edge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the old-fashioned days before baling of hay. Hay would be, dried grass would be left in a huge heap in a rick, mm-hmm. and then you would slice out a big chunk of it to go and feed your animals. So before wrapped bales,
right.
And it's kind of, you know, you've got to imagine maybe 2 feet long, a knife with a long curve and one straight edge, and somewhere you can mm-hmm. put your foot, and so you would tread down to put all that force in to cut through. And so we'll cut off the edges of the wet straw, because on the very edges it'll still be wet. Now this is hugely oxidized juice by this stage.
Yes.
But it's all juice. It's all going to go in the barrel. So we'll cut it. We'll wind it back up. We'll cut the edges off, put them back on the top, and press again.
Press it again.
And we'll get. And we'll usually get. We usually get 350 gallons off the first press, and then 50 gallons off the once we shear the mock. And you end up with that, lovely sharp edge. Looks wonderful. Wow. It was nice taking the picture because you see the wheat reed in profile, like cutting through the straw. Mm, so it's very
beautiful,
very pretty.
The smell in that room. Is it a covered room in the barn?
It's a stone barn cut into the side of a hill for constant cellar temperature.
I mean, can you imagine that? Just the that setting is just so. It's quaint, you know. It's exactly what you want to experience. What does it smell like? You know, can you give us some descriptors for that? Because I can only imagine.
Well, there is. So you've got an earthen floor.
Okay.
And it's stone cut into the hill. So there is a kind of a dank minerality in the air that hangs. And then you've got, oak in contact with juice. You've got a slightly, I want to say, almost like a woodland. A wooden floor, so there's because mm-hmm. there's flora in there, you know.
Sure. Maybe moss growing on the stones on the side of the hill. I mean, this is not like that classic, you know. U.S. makers, I really have to be kind of strict in their cleanliness.
Sure.
It's like a little hospital laboratory sometimes. Mm-hmm.
You
know, this is not like that.
No.
Just imagine an earthen floor, stone walls, maybe a couple bees bopping around, lazy bees, sitting there all day long.
Bats hibernating.
Oh God, I want to just smell that right now.
I
can smell it. Just your descriptor is so perfect. Thank you for doing that, because that all that straw mixed in with the the pressed apple and the juice, it must be just a mix. And then you go from there into the bottle, and you're taking some of that that aroma in the air. Talk about terroir from a specific place.
I tell you what's really special.
Yeah.
What's really special is when you taste the cider in the barn.
Mm.
And it's that moment. It's like, and it tastes fantastic wherever you try it.
Yeah.
And it's very, this is a way that, this is uninterrupted natural fermentation in a way that's been done in that valley for as long as time mm-hmm. can recall.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something special about it in that barn. And actually, we're quite careful when we're doing our blending. We just went and checked this year's fermentations, which are lovely. When we finally pack it, so we'll bring that back to the cider works to be packed. But we make sure we don't make our blending decisions in the barn, because we love everything we try in the barn. And so we're like, oh yeah, we're going to put that with that. It's all sorted. And then you get it back and you try it in a much more, less romantic setting.
Right,
and
right.
It's like, well, actually, I think that's a little bit short. We should have used some more of that other. So, that is the way. But yeah.
How do you market that? Is that in a larger profile bottle? And then who is going after that?
Well, to be honest, that is there to serve the local community, what I would just euphemistically call the old boys, that want their cider bone dry, out of the oak, And so we only sell it as a...
I want to hang out with the old boys and drink that cider.
You'd like it.
Yeah, I think I would.
So they come and bring their containers and we fill it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you know, it's taken from the wood and it's put in their container. It's what they...
Wow.
That's how they want to consume this.
What a special traditional way to do it. That's really incredible.
Yeah. It's lovely, and even the cider works where we are, which is much more modern.
Mm-hmm.
It's more modern than a stone barn cut in a hill.
Sure.
But that's the oldest working cider works in the country. So that was built in 1935, and it was the first example of where it's really the all cider was made in the way that I described. The straw press.
Yes, yes.
And cider, in fact, was the commodity. So a farmer would sell cider, not apples. And really, that was the change. The cider works, which we now occupy, and how we do it, and most cider makers do it, is you buy the apples and you make the cider, and then you can have control over the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't get the variability that you'd have been seeing farm by farm, good
mm-hmm.
cider makers and poorer cider makers. All that cider would have been collected still in the victualers to be bottled. And so people would be blending at that point. And this was an example where they said, well, hang on, if we bring the apples in, we've got control of the whole process. And they brought techniques generally from brewing, but really that was about managing bigger vat sizes, managing fermentation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in Crediton, in Devon, it's not how we do it, but in those days, everything was keeved. So they would be taking from the presses into huge squares where they would do a primary fermentation, hand skim off the Chapeau Brun, and then pump away the clear cider to then ferment. And that was in 20,000-gallon oak vats.
Wow.
And they had 12 each side.
Wow. And what Barney's talking about in the keeved cider, this is... A style of cider making that we're not really seeing in the U.S. at this point. We're seeing it more from Europe, the U.K., Normandy, and it's where the fresh apple juice, before it is fermented, you're looking at like dropping the nutrients out of there, but they don't drop to the bottom. They actually rise to the top and make that Chapeau Brun, which is like a hard brown cap. And then the cider maker, in this case, you're saying they would just skim it right off the top instead of plunging a hole through, right, and sucking it out.
That's right. So there's a guy, I've got a lovely photograph of a chap with a long, you know, like a long pizza paddle, right?
And
he's effectively scraping off. Yeah, and the Devon term for it, so the old boys that I talk to, the cider makers, they'll always call it cleaning the cider.
Cleaning the cider.
They're cleaning it.
Of the brown
and so
cap.
And in the barrel, you would just let it, you'd brim fill.
Yeah.
And it's very early primary fermentation that throws up the hat, that throws up the brown hat. And it's that latent CO2 that then pushes the... pushes the
brown cap up.
That's right.
And what this allows the cider to do then, Ciderville, is that it you get residual sweetness in the cider. And it could often be a very low alcohol cider. Is that what you're seeing? In Normandy, that's what I see. But in the UK, what would be like the typical ABV?
No, you see, so in the UK, no, that would then be allowed to ferment on. So they're just cleaning it.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
A slow and steady fermentation.
Yeah.
The problem is, with a lot of nutrients and no ability to control temperature, then a fermentation can rattle away,
right.
You get very hot, you get lots of defective off notes you can get. So
yeah.
This was a way of getting steady. By dropping the nutrient, you'd get steady, so you can keeve without it being sweet. Yeah, so you're effectively dropping the nutrient for a slow fermentation.
Mm.
The way in which it's achieved in France and Devon, there's a strong history of deliberately making sweet ciders in exactly the way you've described, but not carbonated, so
not
they would just be they'd be
no,
in
bottle ferment, yeah.
And typically it's just multiple rackings, so the minute there's any kind of movement, they'll keep moving and it just keeps on dropping, and the yeast just in the end they give up,
because there's nothing to feed on.
That's it.
thank you to Barney Butterfield of Sanford Orchard for providing that exquisite imagery. I felt like I was right down there in the barn next to that press, seeing the reed being used as a rack, the barley straw as the cloth, and doing it the Devon way. I could feel his passion for his region of the world, that exquisite little spot in Ciderville in the UK. Is really something. Talking about the elmwood being from 1400 and then like passed down through the family. You just feel the history of cider, and what a great storyteller. And just to follow up, if you want to get some of a Sanford Orchard's cider, it is widely available in the UK. So you want to head over there to drink some Sanford Orchard cider. Why not? Right? Why not? The best thing to do if you really want to experience cider is travel to it and drink it on the land where it was made. There is a second half to this conversation with Barney Butterfield, specifically on a eureka moment he had in cider making that he and the cider maker at Sanford Orchard, Annie May, discovered. It comes from a book from 1903, a French book. He was reading the English version of that and kind of was able to see between the pages, not really the pages, but the writing, something in that writing that really ignited his spirit and said, dang, is that what this guy's saying? And then he went on to do some experimental practices. Now, he did bring a bottle of cider that he shared with me. It's called the Yarlington Mill. And that cider is made in a very specific way. And they are doing trials now at Sanford Orchard, and he's working with the University of Exeter too. And it's pretty neat. So that's going out to the super geeks at the Cider Chat Patreon page. And those are the super geeks who are donating $5 or higher to Cider Chat to really help keep this podcast on the air. I have a goal there that I'm trying to reach. With the only cider podcast in the world, the weekly cider podcast. I know there's a couple out there, a couple that have already what we call pod faded. I've been on many years ago. Some that kind of kick out, you know, one here, one there. But Cider Chat has been with you, Ciderville, for four seasons. Every single week, you have over a week's worth of archived podcast material that I'd like to keep up so that you could go back and keep on checking it as you go forward. So again, those super geeks make a difference at that $5 level tier at the Patreon page. And I really appreciate your support. And so as such, you're getting this supremely unbelievable bonus episode here on what they did with that Yarlington Mill and what they are trying to do in trials at Sanford Orchard to increase a mouthfeel profile for that cider. Pretty cool stuff. Again, just go to the Cider Chat Patreon page and you'll get a link there to download that very special episode with Barney Butterfield. And I have a little bit more cider homework for you. If you have been playing with cannabis and cider or distilled apple products such as apple brandy or Calvados, please contact me. I am on the Cider Days, well, the Franklin County Cider Days Committee. I'm actually going to a meeting there very shortly to talk about the program for the 25th annual Franklin County Cider Days happening the first week of November. And we are doing a presentation called Cider and Mary Jane. And we're going to be talking about how to infuse cannabis into cider and some food pairings and a little bit more. So I am going to start putting out the word to you, Ciderville. Do contact me. This is a growing topic. When we presented just the inkling of an idea on that at last year's Cider Days, it got so much attention, so we're going to be pursuing it further. And if you're a hobbyist and you're in a territory in the world where cannabis is legal, then you could work with it, certainly as a hobbyist. And so I want to help educate people, find out more about it myself, and see what we could do to share that knowledge with all of you. If that's a topic that interests you, please send me an email to Rhea, that's spelled R-I-A, at ciderchat.com. Oh, here is a little bit of a news flash for you, hot off the airways. I was just notified by Stem Ciders that that Perry I was speaking about earlier in this here episode is all pear. It's from the western slope of Colorado. And what they mean by that is the Great Divide goes through Colorado, that giant mountain peak that goes like north to south. And the west side of the divide is the western slope, and the east side is Denver and called the Front Range. So the western slope, it really produces quite a bit of stone fruit and has cider products there too. Certainly out in Paonia, that region, if you could visit that, it's a little south of Aspen. So they're bringing in pears from the western slope to make that perry. And I don't know what particular pears are in that. But regardless, it's probably not 100% peri pears, and that's where it gets a little crooked in labeling and stuff. And actually, I'm kind of surprised that they gave a bottle of peri mislabeled to a media group. But it happens. You know what? It's very overwhelming, and I should be really thankful that I got a bottle. That's nice, albeit mislabeled. So I'm glad I followed that up with Courtney at Stem Cider. She's like their media personality there, and that was helpful to know. So there you go. If by chance this is the first time that you're listening to Cider Chat, thank you very much for listening this far. And in case you haven't heard, I am leading a cider tour to Normandy, France, the last week of September. And this year is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. So we definitely mix a lot of cider, a lot of gastronomic experiences with cider dinners, and we are also paying tribute to those who gave their lives during World War II. We'll be visiting Omaha Beach and having a tour at that just amazing site. Recently, I saw a notification that to pay tribute to D-Day, they were doing etchings in the sand. They would lay out like a silhouette and then have people with a shovel kind of make an etching of fallen soldiers in the sand. It was kind of like a live art installation because when the tide came up, it got all washed away. And at first, they just had a small amount of people showing up, and then they were able to do 9,000 silhouettes. I'm going to be putting a link in the show notes so you could see how that installation was created. It was actually produced by, or I should say spearheaded by, two English gentlemen, because America was not the only country who lost people that day, no doubt. So pretty poignant and quite a special time to be able to visit Normandy and to pay tribute. And I would love it if you could come along with me. Do go to the Totally Cider page at ciderchat.com, and you'll find a secure link there to make your bookings for that reservation now. That'll be leaving on September 22nd through the 28th of 2019. This is Rhea Windcaller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville. There's a reason why we do like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There's a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There's a reason why we drink it like this.
Yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking out of the orchard, dancing in the street, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like water.
Yeehaw!